This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Kyle Weens loves to fix things, and he makes a living at it.
I am the CEO of iFixit. iFixit is a free open source community where we teach each other how to fix things, and we've got information on how to fix everything from your iPhone to your toaster.
Weens is on a mission to take us back to a time when there was a TV or vacuum cleaner repair shop in every neighborhood, and you fixed stuff yourself, bicycles, socks, cars. Somewhere around the 1980s, though, that started to change.
The VCR happened. The VCR was the moment where we went from every product that you bought, you could fix it yourself or you could hire a professional. And all of a sudden, the VCRs were complex, cheap plastic parts. Manufacturers stopped including repair information, and that was sort of the beginning of this trend to where now everything is disposable.
What's true of VCRs is doubly true for iPads and smartphones. Well, Kyle Weens and a small army of fixers is fighting back and may just change the way companies do business. Today, as part of our series, Wasted, Neat Solutions to the Dirty Problem of Waste, KCRW's design and architecture correspondent Francis Anderton and reporter Kaylee Wells tell us how.
In the early aughts, Kyle Weens and his business partner Luke Sauls were sharing a dorm room at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
I was looking for information on how to fix my laptop. I had an Apple iBook, and I couldn't find information anywhere online on how to fix it. And so I persevered. I'm an engineer, and so you set me on a task. I'm not going to stop until I do it. And I got it fixed, but it was a lot harder than it needed to be. And I did a little bit of research afterwards and learned that Apple had sent lawyers to take down all repair information on that laptop from the internet.
Now, we have reached out to Apple several times to get their end of this story, and they have not given us a comment.
But certainly the company has a bad track record on this. They've gone after independent repairers, and according to many reports, Apple won't sell iPhone replacement parts.
So anyway, as Kyle Weens saw it,
it was a corporate strategy to prevent people from making their products last longer. And that made me kind of angry. And I said, well, I can do something about it. I know how to fix this thing now. So I took it apart again, and we wrote a repair manual for it, put it online, and it got very popular.
Yay!
And the rest is sort of history.
History means growth into a global community of people who crowdsource fixing information.
Lots of people download their repair manuals and buy their toolkits. What began as a hobby is now a thriving repair business for Kyle.
In a typical month, probably 10 plus million people are using iFixit to learn how to repair something.
And guess who's among those millions?
From the early days, we had people from Apple IP addresses accessing the information so that we know it was useful.
I just want to add here that experts on Apple's design philosophy say that the company's goal has always been to make perfect, sleek, integrated products that they don't really want to have dismantled. And they also say that their devices are designed to last longer than other brands. And in doing so, they're aiming for a balance between repairability and durability.
But in the future, Apple and many others might have to consider the consumer's needs more if a new law passes.
A new law that is being partly written by Kyle. He's helped write a state bill that will require companies to make their parts, their tools, and their information available to consumers and repair shops. It is called Right to Repair, and it is sponsored by California State Senator Susan Eggman. She represents parts of Stockton.
When we purchase something, is it ours or do we just rent it? Because if it is ours, then we should have the right to repair that. And that goes from everything from large farm equipment down to our own personal devices.
Now, it sounds surprising that this isn't already happening, but actually, manufacturers use all kinds of tricks, restrictive warranties, digital locks, proprietary components, all to make it impossible for people to fix stuff.
And this effort to pass right to repair bills is actually picking up steam. California's the 20th state in the U.S. to introduce a right to repair bill.
It's failed to pass in the state legislature so far, but Eggman told us that she does plan to reintroduce it. And I'm going to state the obvious, device makers have pushed back, typically through trade associations that represent them. Arguments against right to repair include
hacking,
because small repair shops will be able to get your data, they say.
Copying.
Repairers will be able to steal proprietary technology.
Danger.
And it might be a fire hazard to let people fix their own devices, actually, because many of these electronics contain combustible lithium-ion batteries.
And that may be a reasonable concern. Lithium-ion batteries, after all, are dangerous. Just listen to Kyle Weens talking about AirPods.
AirPods have three batteries integrated into them. You cannot throw them in the trash because they set garbage trucks on fire when the garbage trucks compact them. You can't run them through municipal recycling because they catch municipal recycling centers on fire when they go through shredders.
Okay, so yeah, having gadgets explode at home when you're trying to dismantle them is a concern. But Kyle says this is a design flaw that designers and manufacturers have got to solve.
Now, for its part, Apple has said that it does support independent repair stores. However, it stresses that repairers should receive specific Apple training, and that's because of the dangers. The company also says that it is in the process of investing in new recycling technologies. Now, one of the arguments against right to repair is that companies are going to lose their competitive edge because their rivals can learn how their products are made.
But waste experts actually say the opposite could be true. Adam Minter is the author of Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale.
If suddenly consumers and repair shops have the right to repair things, you suddenly create an incentive for manufacturers to start creating more repairable devices. And that becomes a way that manufacturers compete with each other.
And in fact, that kind of competition seems to be happening already.
Amazingly, many companies, including some of those big ones, are actively and consciously beginning to dip their toes in the water of the circular economy.
Sandra Goldmark is a set designer, and she's also associate professor at Barnard College. And she just published a book called Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. And she says that things are changing even at a corporate level.
I.e., experimenting with reuse, dabbling in repair even. IKEA is a notable one.
And one of the leaders is a well-known company right here in the Southland, Patagonia.
Think fancy fleece leisure wear. That's especially popular with the tech guys who make unfixable products in the Silicon Valley.
Well, those tech guys can find some fixable leisure wear because you can now buy gently used fleece clothing directly from Patagonia. They have in-house repair.
My hope and my belief is that they're the first, but they're not going to be the only. And that X years from now, I don't know, 2, 5, I hope not 10, you will be able to go into almost any store and that you'll be able to buy used things and you'll also be able to get service for the things you already have.
So this all sounds great, but it's not answering one thing.
Like what?
Well, people don't always want to wear old stuff or sit around sewing and fixing. Time is money. Plus, it's so fun to buy new things. I mean, that's often the point, to be in fashion, wearing this year's color, or owning the latest iPhone and showing it off to your friends.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, Kaylee. And I did ask Sandra Goldmark, author of Fixation. She had a very interesting answer. She says that making and buying stuff is a human trait, and it's not one that we should be feeling guilty about at all. Rather, she says we should take pleasure in it, but in moderation. She says that the things we make and buy and enjoy shouldn't be like empty calories, where we're overstuffed with stuff. And in fact, she paraphrases the food writer Michael Pollan.
Oh, I remember. He famously said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yes, a very clever motto. And here's Sandra's version.
Have good stuff, not too much, mostly reclaimed. Care for it, pass it on.
Words to live by for those concerned about waste.
And budget.
For KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Kaylee Wells. Next week, we will look at a giant waste problem and a fascinating solution that involves expanding plant roots.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Los Angeles has been the star of its own production for more than a century, an inviting and welcoming place over time.
From the beautifully designed Spanish-type station at Los Angeles, in the heart of the City of the Angels, the thrill of Southern California is in the air. In the years since the turn of the century, Los Angeles has grown from a sleepy pueblo to a vast, seething metropolitan city.
That vast city has about 4 million people now, sprawled out over basin, foothills, mountains, and valley. But alas, with more modern shortcomings, like a skyrocketing cost of living and a pandemic that's really highlighting the economic inequalities of the day. So what about the future of LA? Is there some sort of Hollywood ending? Will COVID help us see what needs to be done? Or will we just go back to how it's been for decades? Journalist and author Erin Aubrey Kaplan wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times about it, and she's here to talk about it. Hey, Erin.
Hey, Steve.
You write that Angelenos suffer from a permanent sense of exceptionalism, that there's this new COVID reality in LA. That's the headline. What do you mean by that? I mean, isn't that the criticism that Angelenos have of New Yorkers or perhaps of people in San Francisco?
Yes, but I think our exceptionalism is a very different kind than the kind of exceptionalism New York suffers from. I mean, we don't see ourselves as superior. That's not what I mean. I mean that we are a big American city with all the, you know, issues that come along with that. But we just kind of are, we have a kind of detachment. We kind of see ourselves as kind of special. You know, things happen to us, but maybe it's the Hollywood thing. Maybe it's being on the West Coast, being the last place in the American frontier. But we just see ourselves as kind of a special entity. Being able to bounce back is kind of a cliche, but we have a kind of LA-ness that is just unique to us. And we don't, you know, we absorb things and we kind of return to being LA, and we don't feel that we are as affected by a lot of crises as other cities are. And COVID has really, really shown us that is just not the case.
Do you think, Erin, it's rooted in the fact that LA, you know, for more than a century now, has sort of been the entertainers of the world? And, you know, we have always been the ones, you know, creating alternate realities. And this is not an alternate reality. This is an ultimate reality. And that, you know, I mean, we are obviously mortal.
Yes, we are. And yeah, of course, it's true. I say that in the column that, you know, it being the center still of the entertainment industry, well, the movie industry, the nucleus of the movie industry, we do kind of act that way. We are kind of actors in our own set, which is the city itself. And, you know, that's part of what makes us special, right? And you're right. People come here to, unlike New York, I mean, people go to New York to invent themselves. People come here to sort of reinvent themselves, to be something completely different than they were, or to be nothing at all. And that's a special sort of quality that we see ourselves as having. And it's been really shaken by the pandemic, which I say in the column, you know, first, really to me, it felt like, gosh, we're really actually in this reality show. And it's a little bit exciting. Like, how is this plot going to go? How is it going to turn out? Are we going to beat it? It really felt like a story we were living. And then, of course, as you know, the story just kind of went on and on, and wasn't really a story, but a condition that took hold and really became worse here than in most other parts of the country. And, you know, to be kind of the center, not of a story or narrative we could control, but being the bad, you know, being the bad story, being the, you know, the heart of the crisis is very new to us, I think. And we don't quite know how to respond to it. And the story's still going on. We're still not out of the woods.
No, we're not. We're not out of the woods, although there is hope, a glimmer of hope, especially with the vaccine and the state actually trying to get its act together with the rollout of the vaccine. I know, Erin, in the early days of the pandemic, you know, LA and the state of California, they were both lauded for the handling of COVID. And, you know, you write in your column that, quote, the sobering reality is that Los Angeles was one of the country's biggest COVID disaster areas. It really has been an epicenter. How did we get here?
Well, I guess the truth is we were always here. We just didn't really know it. COVID, like, you know, has exposed a lot of unflattering things about us, about a lot of other places. But one unflattering thing is our massive inequality, that because LA is so spread out and because neighborhoods are so kind of distinct and ethnically different, we just didn't really see it. But COVID got underneath it. And so the places with the most housing density, which tend to be Latino and people of color, got really walloped. And less dense places like the West Side and were just less impacted. Everyone is impacted, but the disparities were really clear. So it exposed racial inequality, but also exposed, of course, you know, our housing inequality, I guess you could say, which goes along with or housing insecurity, which, you know, means that people are, it's very expensive to live here, expensive to live in a single household. So people, you know, double up and triple up and quadruple up. And again, that's mostly people of color who have struggled most economically. So all of this is being revealed by COVID, and it's like we're standing naked in the wind or something. And there's, you know, aren't any immediate solutions to this. Nothing we can really do at the moment except kind of get through COVID, which, as you say, there is hope and there are glimmers and there is an end to this. We still don't know quite yet where it is, though.
Do you think if it were not for COVID, we would just be living in this chasm, you know, where people, you know, where this economic inequality would continue to exist? And by the way, it still exists. I mean, COVID is just, you know, shining a spotlight on it, right?
Yeah, COVID is like an X-ray, you know.
But what do you think? You think COVID, I dare say, is, it's a positive thing that COVID has at least illuminated this to the point where now we know what a dire situation it is. I mean, it's always been a dire situation, but now more people know it.
Yeah. Well, I always think truth, however it's illuminated, is a positive thing. It can be painful. It can be distressing, but it's always a good thing to know. So yes, we know yet again what these disparities are. We know now the real LA, which is, you know, not that we didn't know it, but it just was not foremost in a lot of our minds, I think, even in the minds of people who are living the disparities. You know, we all want to imagine we're something different, you know, especially I think in LA, which is a city of reinvention and aspiration. So it's kind of humbling for us to see ourselves not as being above anything at all or exceptional, but the model of what's going wrong in the country. That's another thing I think we figure our leadership, you know, is exceptional, is sort of its own thing. And that's been even more true the last 4 years during the Trump years, where California was so apart from the rest of the country in a positive way, you know, kind of the seat of resistance. And suddenly we're not the seat of resistance. We're sort of the seat of acquiescence, or the site of this terrible crisis that's befallen not just the country, but the world. And it is a new position for us. But again, you know, the truth that we are seeing hopefully will be the foundation of change, hopefully sooner rather than later.
It's certainly a moment for the mirror, as we say, in Los Angeles. Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, journalist, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Aaron, great having you on. Thank you for your thoughts today.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. There's been a lot of talk about vaccine equity of late. Are health departments successfully vaccinating harder hit areas and hard to reach communities? Or are shots predominantly going into the arms of richer, whiter people? That issue is playing out all over the country, including Orange County. Latinos make up more than 15% of the county's 65 and older residents, but they only account for 9% of the seniors who have received vaccines so far. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist of the LA Times and a regular, of course, here on Greater LA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So last week we talked about what it took to get your dad vaccinated, which was not easy, as you outlined. He was a vaccine skeptic. not so anymore, thankfully. So that took some convincing. He's not alone, though, right? I mean, is skepticism one reason that the county has struggled?
No, I would not say right now, given who's eligible for the vaccine. So you have a lot of older people who want the vaccine. That you have a lot of younger people who want their, you know, their tios and tias and parents and grandparents to get the vaccine. Really, I've seen a lot of the skepticism from younger people, you know, my generation and lower. But I have so many stories of, like, you know, family members who are trying to get the vaccine. Some have been vaccinated and others just can't get an appointment. Or, like in the case of LA County, you know, they just ran out for the day.
Let's talk about the language barrier, too. I mean, how significant is that in Orange County?
This is the biggest barrier, actually. So in Orange County, you still need to download an app in order to be able to book an appointment. And for weeks, the app was only in English. Now, recently, it's in Spanish, and it's supposed to also get translated into Vietnamese and Chinese in the next couple of weeks. But say you're an older Latino who still, like, say, like the example of my dad, again, he has a flip phone. He doesn't know what an app is. So you have to have then family members who are not just conversant in internet ease, but also have the time to be able to take off their job, to be able to, almost like trading for the stock market, you have to be there reloading again and again and again.
Now, the county, Gustavo, rolled out a vaccine scheduling app. You mentioned the app. Your dad doesn't know that much about the app. I mean, so when you talk about it, the app was only in English, and you have to sign up. We've heard a lot about how this digital divide seems to be this big barrier when it comes to getting elderly people like your dad, who has the flip phone, vaccinated. What about in other cases? I mean, are people just not technologically advanced enough to be able to do this? Should there be a different way? Should people be calling on the phone? I mean, what are other ways that people can check it out?
Whatever happened to good old 1-800 number? The county can't set one up and have some workers there just take calls one by one by one and type something up in the computer. If anything, it's another strike against the continued privatization and automation of county government. You're trying to make something as simple and streamlined as possible because it's going to save you money, not because it's going to be convenient for most folks. I understand with a more conversant, you know, more digitally attuned audience, like younger people who most have smartphones. Okay, I understand that. But for this crowd, the older crowd, and not just immigrant folks, by the way, also older white folks who have never been online, they have to take that into account. That's why it's been such a disaster here in Orange County, and you have that divide.
So what about like primary care doctors calling their patients to help set up an appointment?
I know I'm with Kaiser and I've gotten emails telling us like, oh, okay, well, not just yet, especially not myself because I'm not over 65, no matter, even though I might sound like an old person. But no, you need every possible approach. And at least in Santana, that's what's happened because you have this legendary nonprofit, Latino Health Access, who has this program called Promotoras. In other words, volunteers from within the community, and they go out to the community and they do the work, frankly, that the county should be doing. And so in Santana, you have Latino Health Access, who has a voice at the table, by the way, with the county, telling people this is what we need to do. It's not just all online. They're not going to trust a computer, but they'll trust, say, mi comadre Lupe, who tells me, hey, you have to take this vaccine.
All right. So doctor's offices, maybe they can get in touch or you can use the phone. But there's still this issue of vaccine sites, like where to go to actually get vaccinated. Orange County starting to open some smaller sites. I'm reading about, you know, in local schools, community centers, in addition to Disneyland, is that a good idea?
It's like a wildfire. You don't start at the edges. You don't start at the places that have maybe a little bit of char. You go to where the hot zones are. So yeah, you have Disneyland right there in Anaheim, one of the cities most affected. And then the second vaccine site was Soka University in Aliso Viejo, all the way down there in South County, which hasn't been as affected. They should have had at least a smaller one, the county from the start, in Santana, which is the city that's been absolutely walloped. Now, there's going to be a vaccine center at Valley High School, right in the heart of the barrio in Santana. That's a good step, but you should be thinking of these things from the start instead of being reprimanded, you know, almost immediately after the fact. And then at the same time, you know, people who could have gotten the vaccine didn't and passed away.
So many things to think about going forward with the vaccination process. Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the LA Times, regular contributor, of course, to this show. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Yeah. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, even with 200,000 Instagram followers and his own HBO show, a celebrity florist here in L.A. is struggling to keep his store from going under. You're going to hear about him tomorrow, and that store, by the way. If you subscribe to the podcast, you can listen to that and all the other stories on the regular if you feel like it. Have it delivered fresh to your podcast feed at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Give us some feedback, too, at the website. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Paul Smith, Chuck P., Phil Richards, Mike Stark, Amy Taw, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears tonight. Have a great evening.